TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
A quarter century of unheeded warnings. Remembering Stephen Schneider. This is the third part of a tribute to the late climate scientist Stephen Schneider, a Stanford biologist and co-recipient of the Nobel Prize for his work with the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was among the very few who warned of climate change since the 1980s and had the courage to speak out in public, quite literally, until the day he died in the summer of 2010 on his return from a climate conference in Sweden. With Schneider's death, climate science lost one of their most informed and eloquent voices. You will be able to tell for yourself in a moment when Schneider explains why a few degrees warming can make a huge difference, and how exactly science has reconstructed a temperature record going back to Neanderthal from ice cores taken from the thickest glaciers on Earth. In 2005, Schneider had been invited to give the opening address at one of the most important climate conferences of our time. The Hadley Center in England had called the meeting under the title Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change. I would not have known about the conference had I not followed the London Independent newspaper. Here's how the news came to me for the original broadcast. In early February of 2005, a headline appeared in the London Independent. It said, Apocalypse Now, How Mankind is Sleepwalking Towards the End of the Earth. Floods, storms, and droughts, melting Arctic ice, shrinking glaciers, oceans turning to acid. The world's top scientists warned last week that dangerous climate change is taking place today, not the day after tomorrow. The award-winning environmental writer Jeffrey Lean wrote these words, and he continued, quote, Future historians looking back from a much hotter and less hospitable world are likely to pay special attention to the first few weeks of 2005, as they puzzle over how a whole generation could have sleepwalked into disaster, destroying the climate that has allowed human civilization to flourish over the past 11,000 years. End of quote. Alarmed by this report, I searched the U.S. media for more information on this conference and found almost nothing. I did, however, track the report back to the organization that had hosted this meeting and contacted the staff at the Hadley Center in the United Kingdom. They were kind enough to send me 20 hours of recordings of the proceedings, and you are about to hear the first of a 6-part series of reports from that groundbreaking event. The conference was called Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change, and it was held by request of the British government in order to counter the refusal of the United States to acknowledge the urgency of the issue of climate change. They brought together 200 respected scientists from the fields of ecology, glaciology, meteorology, and oceanography. For many years, scientists have shied away from defining what is dangerous. At the Hadley Center, they took on this task. They did this partly from their own sense of urgency and based on their observations of dramatic recent changes. They also followed a mandate laid down in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Article 2 says that the goal of the convention is the, quote, stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous human-caused interference with the climate system. I'm beginning this 6-part series on climate change with an interview with Professor Stephen Schneider. Stephen Schneider is professor of biological sciences at Stanford University. He's doing research on ecological and economic implications of climate change, climate modeling, and the carbon dioxide greenhouse effect.
Since some U.S. corporate-funded scientists claim that a few degrees more might actually be good for us, I began by asking Professor Schneider how he would respond to someone who says that a world average rise of 5 or 6 degrees Celsius is a trivial number. Here's Professor Stephen Schneider.
The difference between an ice age and the current warm period, which took thousands of years to fully complete from, say, 13,000 years ago to 8,000 years ago, the difference is about 5 to 6 degrees C, around 10 Fahrenheit. We could do that in a century and a half if we don't start constraining the use of fossil fuels that are projected for the developing world on top of the developed world through the end of the 21st century. To have the temperature difference between an ice age and an interglacial happening 100 times faster, there is no ecologist anywhere I know who doesn't think that that is a prescription for mass extinction of threatened species. So we really have to look carefully. A few degrees is not a trivial number, and a few degrees may be all it takes to melt the Greenland ice sheet, or most of it, or knock off part of the West Antarctic ice sheet, with 5 to 10 meter sea level rise possible in 1,000 years, and maybe even in a few hundred. So over a few degrees is a real threat if sustained. We know that greenhouse gases trap heat, right? Mars is very cold with a thin greenhouse. Venus is very hot with a thick greenhouse. Earth with a medium greenhouse is in the middle. We know the greenhouse effect works. That's established beyond doubt. We know that we're adding pollutants, carbon dioxide, methane, and so forth. We know that's going to trap heat. That's established beyond doubt. And we know that it's warmer now, about 7 tenths degrees C, plus or minus a few tenths, especially in the last 3 decades, when it really warmed rapidly. All those are facts. The question is, how much of that warming can we lay at the doorstep of the 30% increased CO2, the 150% increase in methane and other human factors? That's tougher, and that requires what we call fingerprint analysis, where you actually look at patterns. For example, if the sun did it, as some skeptics assert, the sun just got warmer. It's a natural thing for the sun to change, although nobody really has any good data on how much. But if you speculate that, then you would have warmed the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, the middle atmosphere, and the surface. That's not what happened. The stratosphere cooled and the surface warmed. That's a fingerprint of human effects, of the combination of ozone depletion and greenhouse gases causes the stratosphere to cool, and the lowering warming of the surface, probably greenhouse gases. That fingerprint alone increases the likelihood that humans, not nature, are responsible certainly for the last 2 or 3 decades worth of warming. What else can we do? The computer models, when you pollute them, that is when you hit them with the amount of greenhouse gases and aerosols that were put in the atmosphere in the last 30 years, they say that mid-latitude continents and high-latitude continents should warm up more than low-latitude continents. Guess what? That fingerprint happened. It says the middle of continents should warm up more than the middle of oceans. That happened. Now, every one of these fingerprints has weak correlation. They're not perfect correlations, but every one of them is in the right direction. What's the probability that 3 or 4 fingerprints are all lining up in the right direction, are all consistent with theory, and then say the theory is wrong? It's highly probable the theory is right. But this is circumstantial evidence. But it's very strong circumstantial evidence, more than enough to convict in a civil trial in the United States, where the preponderance of evidence standard is more than half. We're probably more than 95% sure that humans are in the act. We're just not in 99.9, sort of the standard for conviction of a criminal, right, beyond a reasonable doubt. That's going to take another couple of decades, except we're performing this experiment on the laboratory we call Earth, and it's a bit risky to mess around with a life support system, and that's why most governments want to slow down the experiment and buy time to figure out what can happen. So the recent behavior of the Earth, when it warmed up, was projected by many of us in the 70s and 80s, but then we were operating on theory. So what when people say, so what's different now? What have you learned? And we said, well, I don't think that we've learned a lot of new theory. I think what happened is that nature cooperated with theory and showed this dramatic warming of the last few decades. And not only did the glaciers melt at the same time and the sea levels rise a little bit and the thermometers show warming, but plants and animals have been moving around. They bloom earlier in the spring. The birds come back from the tropics earlier. They lay eggs earlier. Butterflies move up mountains and move toward the poles. Every bit of this data is all consistent. And what is the likelihood that this vast avalanche of multiple consistent lines of evidence, each one of which is assailable, but collectively all line up, that they don't add up to a clear picture that humans are disturbing the system? And that's what IPCC has been reporting, and in my opinion, will report more strongly. And the Exeter meeting took it one step beyond that and said, well, we're not going to give you a single number, but most of us in the room think, let's not go over 2 degrees warming above pre-industrial. That's just too risky.
Now, how do we know that the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have increased by 30% over historic times?
One of the few things we understand with high degree of confidence is that CO2 is up about 30% over pre-industrial. And the reason we know that isn't because we directly measured CO2 like we have at Mauna Loa Observatory of the South Pole since the mid-1950s. It's because when you go to the ice cores that you take in the tops of very, very tall plateaus in the tropics in Greenland, in Antarctica, and you realize that each year when the snow falls in these very, very cold places, it doesn't melt. And if anybody has ever stepped on a snow fall, you know that you squeeze it. Well, what are you squeezing out? The air between the snow grains. But what happens in an ice field is that nobody's stepping on it. The thing that squeezes it is next year's snowfall. And next year's snowfall, so you get squished, you get pressure on it, and soon the snow is squeezed into ice. But what happens to the air that was in between the snow grains? It gets trapped as bubbles left behind in the ice. So when you drill a hole in the ice cap and you get a core and you take it back to the lab and you analyze the content of the gases in there, you can find out literally a library of the history of the Earth's atmosphere back past Neanderthal times. You know, we can go back hundreds of thousands of years and figure out what had happened. And that's why there's very, very high confidence in the scientific community that the 30% increase in carbon dioxide and 150% increase in methane is A, real, and B, due to human activities, because there are other fingerprints, such as the kind of molecules left behind. The isotopic composition of carbon dioxide is different for fossil fuels than for carbon dioxide produced by decomposition of organic matter. Right when the leaves die, they give you CO2. When we breathe, we get CO2. Well, that has a different ratio of heavy carbon to light carbon, and you can take a look at the relative ratios and find out since the industrial era, the amount of carbon-14, that's the heavy carbon, the radioactive stuff, has gone down substantially. Why? Because fossil fuels are 100 million years old and there's no radiocarbon left. It's all gone. So as a result of that, we have exceedingly high confidence that humans are responsible for this change in concentration. And even the skeptics don't argue that. They try to argue it doesn't make any difference or it's good for us.
What I saw in your report, as well as in other charts, that there has always been a correlation between CO2 and warming. How do we know that?
Well, we know that in the ice ages, there was much less CO2 and methane than there was in the interglacials, the warm periods. It's complicated, though, because sometimes it started to get a little bit cooler before the CO2 dropped. So the skeptics say, you see, CO2 is just a reaction of temperature. There's nothing to do. You can't prove that global warming works because of that. But they're wrong, because it doesn't matter what initiated the cooling. All you need to know is that if CO2 became less concentrated in the atmosphere in the ice age, that's an amplifier. It makes the ice age more intensely cold than it otherwise would have been. And when the ice age started to end and CO2 went back up with it, it made it more intensely warm. So it's a feedback or an amplifier. And when people try to build models of the ice age and they try to figure out how can they reconcile the, you know, the 5 to 7 degrees Celsius cooling in an ice age relative to now, and they try to do it in a model where they hold the carbon dioxide and the methane fixed, nobody's been able to produce any signal that looks large enough. But when you allow the greenhouse gases to change, then your model simulates the Ice Age interglacial conditions much better than without it. Now, that's circumstantial evidence again. That is not proof positive. Maybe it's just a coincidence. But it's not too probable that Mars, Earth, and Venus would show how greenhouses work. The recent 30 years where the increase in CO2 and methane is correlated with warming, and the fact that there was less greenhouse gas in the atmosphere in the cold times and more in the warm, all of that taken together makes a very, very strong circumstantial case that that greenhouse gases are part of the climate system. And as we increase them by doubling, tripling, or quadrupling them, if the world insists on 10 billion people, they insist on the standard of living of the OECD countries, and they insist on using Victorian industrial technologies like internal combustion engine cars and coal burning and oil burning, we are going to more than triple CO2 in the 21st century. And we would be very lucky to have warming less than 3 or 4 degrees if we triple CO2. It could even be 5 or 6. And in the latter, in almost every analysis, has many catastrophic components. And we are just gambling if we think that we can get away with that and hope for the best.
Now, in your presentation, you spoke about surprises. You said there are imaginable surprises and true surprises. What did you mean by that?
If you asked me in the spring of 2004, the maximum number of people that could die in a super heat wave in Europe in 2005, I would have said, let me stick myself out on a limb. I would say 1,000 people maximum. Well, how many died in the 2004 heat wave? An astronomical number, like 30,000? Beyond the imagination of any of us. I don't know anyone for whom that wasn't a true surprise. Undoubtedly, most of the surprises, like melting ice sheets and changing Gulf Streams and species extinction and super hurricanes, have already been imagined and some even calculated, though salient political groups would be surprised if they happen. But there are undoubtedly more Euro heat waves that nobody's even thought of yet to come. And the only thing the scientific community can say competently about that, and IPCC already has said that, is that the more we push the system, and the more rapidly we push the system, the higher the likelihood of getting surprises. So therefore, the obvious conclusion is let's slow down the rate at which we dump our waste in the atmosphere like it's a sewer and buy ourselves time to figure out what's going on and not perform a dangerous experiment on a life support system of the Earth.
Let's take the surprises one by one, and let's take the Gulf Stream. That I read is not a surprise because the Gulf Stream has reversed itself before.
It's certainly not a surprise. The reason we call it an imaginable surprise, although I don't think the word surprise is really appropriate anymore for that, is the models are all over the place. Some models suggest that the circulation which keeps the high North Atlantic free of sea ice in the winter and therefore much, much warmer than Hudson Bay at the same latitude, that could collapse with global warming. All the data that we have and evidence that this occurred in the past is primarily in the Ice Age. And the reason that the sea ice came and went had to do with the discharge of icebergs, and icebergs are fresh water, and fresh water freezes more easily than salty water. So it was the Ice Age conditions themselves which caused the 15 or 20 dramatic episodes of very, very rapid climate change where you change 5 degrees in a decade. The question is, can we do the same with warming? All we have is theoretical evidence and modeling evidence now. And the way we test our models is we run them on historic cases, and when they give us some semblance of reality in historic cases, then we at least have modest confidence in them to project the future. So the status of those models is that we think they're plausible, but nobody would assign them high confidence. The problem is that there is at least a 10% chance of creating that kind of dramatic reorganization of our ocean currents. And if that would be for warming up a few degrees, supposing we warmed up more than a few degrees, 4, 5, and 6, then the model suggests a very high likelihood that we would dramatically realter the ocean circulation with potentially significant consequences for Northwest Europe and other parts of the world. So once again, it brings us back to the point that the more rapidly and the stronger we push the system, the higher the likelihood of those things that we can imagine but don't have enough data to be confident in would occur. What keeps Northern Europe so much warmer than, say, Hudson Bay at the same latitude, the same thing that keeps British Columbia much warmer than Hudson Bay, is the onshore flow of winds that have run over a warm ocean. So the whole key is to keep the sea ice out, because sea ice is like a surrogate landmass on the oceans, and that allows dramatic cooling of the surface, and then the winds wouldn't be warmed. Sea ice is very strongly dependent on the salinity. The more salty the water, the less the sea ice, because the water is dense, it sinks, and therefore it keeps enough mixing going that it doesn't freeze much in a winter. So if you started to shut down the Gulf Stream's penetration to the northern latitudes, and that reduced the flow of the salty water associated with the Gulf Stream, then you would increase the chances of getting seasonal sea ice moving further south. And it's that sea ice that threatens Europe to get cold while the rest of the world might be getting warm.
So what about the scenario in the movie The Day After Tomorrow?
The Day After Tomorrow is Hollywood. It's a morality play. I sort of think of it, I tell my students and they ask me about it. It's a, the Earth strikes back scenario. The actual science in it has no chance of being real. There is no way you can drop temperature degrees in a second. You probably couldn't do ocean temperature changes degrees in a week. It takes a long time for that to happen. Nobody has ever suggested that a collapse of the North Atlantic circulation could occur immediately. Yes, in the past, it probably occurred within 10 years, but it took hundreds of years to get the conditions prime for that eventual fall off the cliff, 10-year event. So the day after tomorrow has no scientific reality with regard to the specific scenario, but its recognition that what humans are doing can cause dramatic changes to the Earth that require climate policies is way ahead of the philosophy in the West Wing of the White House right now, even if the scenario is fanciful and impossible. And the world is not helped by the counter polemics that you get from people like Michael Crichton, whose state of fear is a counter-polemic that I would call the day before yesterday, going backwards. And what he offers as a counter is equal scientific garbage. And it's very unfortunate that the media has a field day, quoting Crichton against this movie, when both of them represent absolutely impossible scientific situations. The main point that I made to the group was that there was at least a first decimal point odds, right? That means greater than 10% chance, and in some cases greater than 50% chance, that there will be 8 to 10 billion people in the world by the end of the century. There's at least a first decimal point odds chance that they will want to use the cheapest available energy supplies, like coal, and use up the rest of the oil, and that we'll dump our waste in the atmosphere without charge because people won't want to pay any economic costs for doing that. And therefore, there's a first decimal point odds that we will double, triple, or even further increase carbon dioxide at the end of the 21st century and into the 22nd century. And I would argue there's a first decimal point chance odds of at least 50% that warm up way over the 2 degrees C that the EU would like to keep us under. And we could warm up as much as 5 or 6 degrees C in the middle of the 22nd century. When you put all those first decimal point odds possibilities together, it seems hard not to conclude that the current development path for humans has the potential to be dangerous. And our argument is that nobody can come along and say there's a specific number that's dangerous, but that we can look at it like a roulette wheel. We can look at it probabilistically, and we can say, Well, we have a 10% chance that we'll be lucky and we'll warm up under 2 degrees and we'll get away with it with only stresses for some ecosystems and coastal states and small island states and some vulnerable people who will be hurt by heat waves. We can also say there's a 10% chance that we're going to melt West Antarctic ice sheet, Greenland, redirect the Gulf Stream, increase the intensity of hurricanes and droughts, floods, and fires, and that we'll have catastrophic outcomes all around the world blooming. And I would not rule that out at a 10% chance, and then everything else in between. So what we do is we show probability functions, these upside-down bell curves, which are risk management ways of seeing the world. And we said by analogy, imagine a corporation that wouldn't make an investment to try to hedge its bets if there were a 10 or 20% chance that some event would be economically catastrophic. They'd be out there buying insurance. They'd be out there trying to change the situation. I mean, we had people using weapons of mass destruction as an excuse for an invasion, and the probabilities that they had for those were well less than those for serious climate change. So the precautionary principle is applied in security, it's applied in business investments and in health, and somehow there are politicians and anti-environmental organizations who think that in environmental science we're supposed to be 99.9% sure on objective statistics, whereas in every other walk of life they hedge on a hunch. And the main point that I made is that responsible science must point out the probabilistic nature and say that we're talking about changing the profile of risk, not waiting for absolute truth, because absolute truth will not happen until the Earth performs the experiment of telling us what we're doing, and by then it's too late to stop it.
You heard my last interview with the late Dr. Stephen Schneider, one of the strongest, most eloquent, and best-informed voices on the dangers of climate change. We spoke in March 2005 after his return from England, where he gave the opening address to 200 scientists at the Hadley Center meeting on Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change on February 1, 2005. Stephen Schneider was professor of biological sciences at Stanford University and former department director at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Boulder, Colorado. Schneider was also coordinating lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Assessment Reports. The interview you just heard was originally broadcast as part one of a six-part series on the Hadley Center Conference. Topics included Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet melting, possible reversal of the Gulf Stream, ocean acidification, and impact on plants. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a CD copy of this tribute to Stephen Schneider that includes my 2001 interview with him on his work with the IPCC. You can get information on how to order a CD by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call. Thank you.